Welcome to the OrthoClips podcast series, where we're going to discuss the latest hot topics and high-impact papers in orthopedic surgery. I'm your host, Saqib Rahman. Let's get this episode started. Welcome to the second episode of Season 6 of the OrthoClips podcast series. This is an interesting one. We're going to talk about external fixation and when you have to convert that to open reduction internal fixation or intramedullary nailing. We're doing X-Fix a lot for open fractures, maybe damage control, either for a periarticular fracture that's being staged or damage control orthopedics, perhaps a femur fracture in a multiply injured patient that's not physiologically stable for an intramedullary nail. So questions are how to deal with the pin tracts, timing of conversion, you know, how long can you have that X-Fix on? We have a lot of concerns about how well you can sterilize that external fixator, because sometimes when you go back to the operating room, let's say you have an open fracture and it requires another debridement. Well, the whole reason for being in the operating room that next time is to decontaminate things, to debride any devitalized tissue. But let's say there's an external fixator already on there. You have this open pilon fracture, it needs a second debridement. You could take it off, but are you going to really take it on and off again and again? You put it on for stability. So the concerns are, how do you sterilely prep an X-Fix? It's got all these crevices. It's got lots of areas for bacteria to grow on. So in this episode, we're going to focus on a couple of papers. There is a nice paper review article that came out in the JAAOS. That's the Journal of the American Academy of Orthopedic Surgery, October 1st, 2024. Edition entitled External Fixation Before Planned Conversion to Internal Fixation in Orthopedic Trauma, Controversies and Current Trends by Drs. Nguyen and colleagues. And we're going to look at one other paper entitled Safety of Prepping the External Fixator in Situ During Staged Internal Fixation of Pilon Fractures, a Retrospective Comparative Cohort Study. So the first, and this paper actually was in the September 2023 Journal of Orthopedic Trauma, so reaching back a little bit, and this is obviously a clinical study, and the other was a review paper. And I am going to also mention a little bit about a study that we're doing at our institution, at Temple University Hospital, in our microbiology department, in which, and that data is going to be presented at the Orthopedic Trauma Association meeting this weekend in Montreal. So, and that looks at evaluating the efficacy of disinfecting agents on external fixator devices. I mean, we talked about how difficult it can be. And in that study, we took external fixator devices, we contaminated them with Staphylococcus aureus, and then we treated it with different disinfectants and then tried to see which ones were the most effective. I mean, we found that, you know, they all, you know, and the ones we used were isopropyl alcohol, chlorhexidine gluconate, betadine, chloroprep, which is a combination. And we found that they all significantly reduced the bacterial presence compared to control. And chlorhexidine gluconate was probably the most effective, followed by isopropyl alcohol. And we found that the junctions where you measured made a difference. So for instance, you know, some of the pin to the multi-clamp junctions had all kinds of different levels of bacterial growth. So you really have to be careful of those specific areas that can be hard to prep. Bunch of things to keep in mind with the review paper that we discussed, the paper from Nguyen, External Fixation Before Planned Conversion to internal fixation, as well as the other paper, the pin insertion technique. So thermal necrosis is obviously something you want to try to avoid to minimize loosening and infection risk, especially if those pins are going to be in for a little while. Pin site care, what they reported was it is somewhat all over the place. So inconclusive evidence on what you need to do with the pins themselves once you put them in. What about timing? So for femur fractures, they recommend usually If a patient's physiologically stable, getting that X-Fix off within 7 to 14 days, and tibia fractures, earlier conversion is probably preferable, even within 7 days if you can. Now, what they wrote and their findings in their review paper was that the data suggests that prepping the X-Fix in situ during conversion does not increase the infection risk, and even mentioned that it may offer advantages by having that mechanical stability while you're working. It can maintain reduction. It may be cost effective. So if you do need a frame, you don't have to put another one on. What about pin site overlap with plate fixation? Well, in plateau fractures, we have some mixed evidence. So I think there's still a feeling that you should try to avoid overlap if at all possible. In pilon, calcaneus, and distal radius fractures, we haven't seen a significant association between pin site overlap and infection risk. What about pin site management after removal? There is a lack of consensus, although there's some recent data showing that, you know, when you take that X-Fix off, those pin sites, you can clean them up and potentially close them and get good results. Now, what we've done in our practice is we'll often clean them out, approximate them. I'll often do like a single suture, for example, so that if a little bit of drainage needs to take place, we're not trapping that in there, but it allows much faster healing of the wound than having this potentially slightly gaping wound that could be, like in the tibia, very close to, for instance, a drill hole that goes down to a nail, right? So you could be millimeters away from an implant if you converted an X-Fix to an intramedullary nail, let's say, or if a plate's down there, which we said is not ideal. But nails, you often can't avoid being in communication with those external fixator pin sites. So consider possibly cleaning them up and closing them, or at least approximating them a little bit like I described. So let's get into the AI host discussion. I've actually given it a few more prompts in order to tighten things up and make it a little bit more scientific, a little bit less generalized, and hopefully you're gonna enjoy this one.
All right, everybody. Scalpels out for this deep dive. We're gonna get our hands dirty with a question that sounds deceptively simple. How do you minimize infection risk when you're switching from external to internal fixation for orthopedic trauma?
It's a procedure that happens all the time, right? But the details, those are what can really trip you up.
Which is why we're lucky enough to have Wynn's recent review to guide us. And to make things even juicier, we'll also be digging into two research papers, one by Horowitz, and that one looks at the surprisingly tricky question of sterilizing external fixators, and the other by Yuramosu, which, well, let's just say it throws down the gauntlet when it comes to timing.
Wynn's paper does a great job of laying out the current thinking on this, pulling together all the research, the controversies, to try and give us a clearer picture of what really works best.
Okay, so for anyone out there who hasn't had the pleasure of breaking a bone lately, and seriously, kudos to you. Let's start with the basics. We're talking about those gnarly fractures where instead of a cast, they've got this external fixator thing going on.
Think of it like scaffolding, but for your bones. You've got pins and wires going right through the skin into the bone, all anchored to these external bars. It's like buying time for the bone to heal up properly.
Yeah, those things, they're kind of hard to miss in pictures. But then comes the big switch, right? Taking down that external hardware and putting in the permanent stuff plates, screws, the whole shebang.
Exactly. But there's a catch. Those pin sites where they pierce the skin, they're basically open doors for infection, and that can really throw a wrench in the recovery process. Wynn's article goes deep on this. How do you minimize that risk when you're doing this conversion?
Okay, let's unpack that. One thing that really jumped out at me from Wynn's paper was how much debate there is about what to actually DO with the external fixator during the surgery itself.
Right. For a long time, surgeons were taught to remove it completely before even starting on the internal fixation. Clean slate, you know. Oh. Minimize any chance of those nasty bacteria hitching a ride from the fixator into the surgical site.
Sounds logical. But is that actually how it works out?
Not necessarily. Wynn talks about some newer research, studies by Moon, Stenquist, Nielsen, and they looked at what happens when they prep the fixator but left it in place. And guess what?
Okay, you're killing me. What did they find?
No difference in infection rates, which is huge GE. It could mean shorter surgeries, less pain, faster recovery, real game changer stuff if it holds up.
Wow, okay, that's big. Talk about shaking things up. So leaving the external fixator on during the procedure might not be the infection risk we thought it was.
Maybe not. But we need more research before surgeons ditch the old playbook entirely. Like, what's the best way to prep it if we're going to leave it in? What are the specific situations where it might be riskier? Lots to figure out.
That's what makes this whole field so fascinating. It's a never-ending process of testing and refining and sometimes completely overturning what we thought we knew.
And that constant evolution is how we make sure our patients are getting the absolute best care possible.
Speaking of patient care, there was another study, Wynn talked about this one, by Yarmosu, and it really zeroed in on timing, right? Like, how long is too long to have that external fixator on there?
Yes, Yarmosu. Their focus was on these notoriously tricky pylon fractures we're talking about, the bottom of the shin bone, right above the ankle. A ton of forces converge in that area, so they can be a real bear to treat.
Yeah, those don't sound fun to break. So what did they find out about timing?
They found a very clear link between how long that external fixator was on and the risk of infection. Basically, every single day matters.
Okay, so the longer those pins are in, the more chances for troublemakers to get in. But wasn't there a magic number, a time frame, where the risk really shot up?
30 days. If that fixator was on for 30 days or more, the infection risk went way up. And get this, it was actually a bigger risk factor than things like diabetes or even having an open fracture to begin with.
Whoa. So it's not just about being careful. It's about being efficient. The faster you can get that internal fixation in and the external one out, the better.
Ideally, yes. But it's not always that cut and dry. Every fracture is different. Every patient heals at their own pace. Surgeons have to find that balance between minimizing infection risk and making sure the bone is actually strong enough to handle the internal hardware.
There's that art of medicine thing again, right? It's not just about following a recipe. Speaking of which, let's talk about placement for a sec. Where those pleats and screws go seems like it could be another minefield for infections.
It can be, and Wynn gets into the research on whether it's safe to have the internal hardware overlap with those old external fixator pin sites.
Okay, I'm listening. What's the verdict?
For most bones, the jury's still out. More research needed. But when it comes to tibial plateau fractures, there's a study by Haas that's hard to ignore.
Oh, that doesn't sound good.
Yeah, they looked specifically at tibial plateau fractures and found a much higher rate of deep infections when that internal plate overlapped with the old pin sites.
So that's something surgeons definitely need to be aware of when they're dealing with those types of fractures. Avoiding that overlap whenever possible seems like it could really make a difference.
It shows just how important it is for surgeons to stay up to date, because even these little distinctions can have a big impact on how well someone heals.
Absolutely. We don't want to miss any of those crucial details. Speaking of details, I want to go back to a study by Horowitz that Wynn talked about, because this one goes right to the heart of sterility. Can you even really sterilize an external fixator?
That's exactly what Horowitz wanted to know. I mean, those things have so many little nooks and crannies. Seems like bacteria heaven, right?
Yeah, I can imagine some of those microbes would be pretty hard to evict. What did they find?
They tried all sorts of common disinfectants, and while those disinfectants did a good job of reducing the bacteria, they didn't wipe them out completely.
So even with our best efforts, there might be a few microscopic squatters hanging around.
It seems likely. Which brings up a really interesting question. What does sterile enough actually mean in this context? It's not like we can just nuke these things into oblivion.
Right. There's got to be a balance, right? So how do surgeons figure out where that line is? It's almost like, what's an acceptable level of risk, right? You can't eliminate it entirely, so where do you draw the line?
It really is a balancing act, weighing the potential benefits of the procedure against that small but unavoidable chance of something going wrong.
And that's where things like surgical technique and understanding those subtle risk factors we talked about becomes so important.
Exactly. Horowitz actually took it a step further, looking not just at the whole fixator as one big thing, but at all those little junctions where the pins connect to the clamps, all those tiny crevices.
Yeah, I can only imagine what's lurking in there.
Well, they found that some of those spots were much harder to disinfect than others. And get this, Staphylococcus aureus, one of the big culprits in infections, they actually seem to prefer certain junctions.
It's like bacteria have their favorite seeds on the external fixator express. So what do you even do with that information?
It just goes to show how much detail goes into planning these procedures, trying to minimize that risk at every single step.
It's a whole other world. Okay, so we've talked about the fixator itself, prepping it, sterilizing it, even where those internal plates should go. But Wynn also goes into what happens after the external fixator comes over off, right? What do you do with those pin sites that are left behind?
Ah, yes, the pin sites. Another potential entry point for those pesky bacteria if they're not managed properly. Wynn actually mentions a survey where they found that most surgeons preferred to leave those pin sites open to heal rather than stitching them closed.
Interesting. Is that to avoid trapping bacteria inside, like giving them a cozy little breeding ground?
That's the traditional thinking. Let them heal from the inside out. But of course, newer research is starting to challenge that idea. There was a randomized controlled trial fairly recently where they looked at this very question.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What did they find?
Turns out the pin sites that were sutured closed actually healed faster.
Wow, so much for tradition. But what about infection? Surely closing them up must increase the risk.
You'd think so, right? But they didn't actually find a difference in infection rates between the two groups.
So faster healing without increasing the risk of infection. Sign me up.
It's promising, for sure. But we do need to keep in mind that this particular study only looked at pin sites in the lower extremities. So more research is needed to see if this holds true in other parts of the body.
Right, because what works for the legs might not work for the arms or the pelvis or wherever. But it's still a really interesting finding that could change how surgeons approach those pin sites in the future.
Definitely something to keep an eye on. It just goes to show how even these seemingly small details can have a real impact.
Absolutely. And speaking of details, I kind of want to rewind for a second and dig into the actual application of these external fixators. Wynn gets into the surgical techniques involved, and I'll be honest, just thinking about it makes me a little squeamish.
I don't blame you. We see those external fixators, and we don't necessarily think about what it takes to actually put them on and manage them afterwards. It's pretty incredible when you break it down.
No kidding. So where do you even begin? What are surgeons thinking about when they're putting one of these things on?
Well, one of the big ones is minimizing damage to the bone when they're putting those pins in. Drilling into bone creates heat, and too much heat can actually kill bone tissue, which is obviously not ideal.
Ouch. Talk about adding insult to injury.
Right. So to avoid that, they'll often pre-drill the holes for the pins, helps dissipate some of that heat, and minimize the risk of what's called thermal necrosis, which is basically bone death from overheating.
Okay, so like preheating your oven, but for bones.
Exactly. And there's even some debate about whether that pre-drilling step is always necessary with some of the newer self-drilling pins that are out there now. But Wynn points out that even with those, you still want to be mindful of that heat.
Better safe than sorry, especially when it comes to something as important as bone. Okay, so let's say the holes are prepped, ready to go. How do they get those pins in there without, you know, causing more damage?
Well, that's where experience and surgical skill come into play. It's all about finding that balance between applying enough pressure to actually get the pin through, but not so much that you're wiggling it around and making the hole bigger.
That sounds so delicate.
Yeah.
I bet you need incredibly steady hands for that.
You do. And it gets even trickier when you consider the type of bone, the location of the fracture, how much stability you need from the fixator.
So it's not just a one-size-fits-all kind of thing.
Not at all. Wynn talks about how the ideal pin configuration is often something called near-far-far. Basically, you're putting two pins close to the fracture site on each side, and then two more pins further away. Helps distribute the load and create a more stable structure.
So it's like building a bridge, you need those extra supports.
Exactly, but you also have to think about the foundation, which in this case is the patient's soft tissues, the skin, the muscles, all of that. Because remember, those pins are going straight through all of that.
And if those pins aren't placed just right, or if the whole fixator isn't positioned correctly, it can really do a number on those tissues, right?
Absolutely. Wynn really emphasizes how important it is to minimize the distance between those external fixator bars and the skin. Leave enough room for swelling, of course, but you don't want it too far away either.
Finding that sweet spot. Enough support, but not too much pressure.
Exactly. And while we're on the topic of all the skill that goes into this, I think it's important to remember that the fixator itself, it's not a magic bullet. It's not like you can just slap it on and call it a day. There's a lot of ongoing management involved in making sure everything heals up the way it should.
Right, because even with the external fixator in place, things can still go sideways.
Unfortunately, yes. One thing surgeons worry about is something called frame creep.
Frame creep. Okay, that sounds creepy. What is that exactly?
It's basically when that external fixator starts to shift out of position. Can happen gradually over time as the soft tissues settle and the bones start to heal.
So like a slow motion disaster if it's not caught early on.
Exactly. And if it's not addressed, it can lead to the bones healing in a bad position, which obviously you don't want.
Yikes. No kidding. So how do they monitor for that? frequent x-rays.
That's the main thing. Yeah. Wynn talks about how important those regular x-rays are just to check the position and make sure everything's still where it should be. And if they do see any signs of frame creep, they might have to go back in and adjust the fixator, maybe even replace some of the parts.
Definitely not a set it and forget it kind of thing. So much more involved than I ever realized.
Definitely not. And that's especially true when you're dealing with those joint-spanning external fixators, like the ones they use for those tibial plateau and pylon fractures we were talking about earlier.
Right, because now you've got the joint to worry about, which adds a whole other layer of complexity.
Exactly. One thing Wynn points out is that with those joint-spanning fixators, surgeons have to be really careful about where they're positioning the pins and bars in relation to the fluoroscopy machine.
Fluoroscopy, remind me what that is again.
Oh, right. It's that real-time x-ray they use during surgery so they can see what they're doing in there.
Right, right. So they need to make sure the fixator isn't blocking the view.
Exactly. Yeah. If you can't see what you're doing, it's a lot harder to make sure everything's in the right place.
Like trying to perform surgery with one hand tied behind your back.
Pretty much. And then even after they do the internal fixation surgery, there are still some situations where they might actually decide to leave the external fixator on for a bit longer.
Really? I thought the goal was to get that thing off as soon as possible.
You're right. Generally speaking, the sooner the better. But there are exceptions. Sometimes, especially with really severe open fractures where there's been a lot of damage to the soft tissues, they might want to leave the external fixator on for a while just to protect those tissues.
So it's like a little protective cage while those tissues are still vulnerable.
Exactly. Gives them a better chance to heal up before they have to deal with all the normal stresses and strains of moving around.
Fascinating. So adaptable, these fixators, depending on what the situation calls for.
They really are incredible tools. And it speaks to the ingenuity of the surgeons who are constantly finding new and better ways to use these techniques to help their patients. But I think it's important to remember that as amazing as these procedures are, they're not without their downsides. We've talked a lot about the physical risks, but there's a psychological component to this as well, right?
Oh, absolutely. Having a severe fracture is traumatic enough as it is, but then to have to go through multiple surgeries and have this big, clunky external fixator, I can only imagine what that does to you mentally and emotionally.
It's a lot to deal with. And while Wynn's paper doesn't really touch on that aspect, I think it's something we need to be mindful of. Healing isn't just about bones and tissues. It's about the whole person, mind, body, spirit, the whole package.
Couldn't agree more. Healthcare needs to take that holistic view, you know, addressing all aspects of a person's well-being. But before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, I wanted to circle back to something you mentioned earlier about open communication between doctors and patients. Why is that so crucial, especially in a situation like this where there's so much going on? It's about feeling like you're actually in control, right? Like you understand what's happening and you're part of the decision-making process.
Exactly. It shouldn't be like, I'm the doctor, you're the patient, do what I say.
Right. More like a partnership, right? Working together towards a common goal.
Exactly. The doctor lays out the options, explains the risks and benefits, makes sure the patient understands what's what, and the patient, they're free to ask questions, bring up their concerns, really be an active participant in their own care.
And when that happens, everybody wins, right?
Yeah.
Better outcomes all around.
Absolutely. Patients who feel informed and empowered, they're more likely to stick to their treatment plans, they recover better, and they just have a better experience overall.
Makes sense. So as we wrap up our deep dive into the world of external fixation and infection control, is there like one big takeaway you hope our listeners will walk away with?
You know, what gets me every time is just how much thought goes into every single aspect of this. From the moment they decide to put that external fixator on to the timing of the conversion surgery, even how they manage those pin sites afterwards, it's all about making careful decisions, weighing the risks and benefits, and always, always trying to do what's best for that individual patient.
It's like a high-stakes game of chess, but with bones and screws.
Pretty much. And it just goes to show you, as amazing as all these medical advancements are, they're only as good as the people who are using them.
So true. Having those skilled and compassionate healthcare professionals on your team makes all the difference.
Couldn't agree more. It's really an honor to be a part of this field, to see what these surgeons do every day to help people heal.
Well said. And to everyone listening, we hope this deep dive has given you a new appreciation for just how complex orthopedic trauma can be and how much goes into getting people back on their feet, literally.
And remember, knowledge is power. So if you ever find yourself in a similar situation, don't be afraid to ask questions, advocate for your needs, be involved in the process. You've got this.
Absolutely. It's your body, your health. You call the shots. Keep asking those questions, keep learning, and until next time, keep diving deep.